Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Clare, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, who assesses the control of Iraqi oil as a central motive behind President Bush's goal of overthrowing the government of Saddam Hussein. Gene Bruskin of U.S. Labor Against the War, who talks about how unions are organizing to oppose the Bush administration's plan for war with Iraq. And Lloyd Dumas, professor of political economy at the University of Texas, who discusses the lessons he believes government planners should learn about technology and human fallibility from the tragic loss of 7 astronauts on the Columbia space shuttle. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a week of massive protests and political violence, a French-backed peace deal in the West African nation of Ivory Coast appears to be in tatters. Over 100,000 people marched in support of current President Laurent Gbagbo and against anything French. Many in the Ivory Coast accuse France of secretly backing the rebels, who broke away from the nation's military last fall, in an attempt to depose the sitting president. A peace deal was signed on January 25th in Marcoussis, France. It called for a government of national reconciliation and eventually new elections. The accord also called for a new prime minister to run the government. Inside Ivory Coast, the peace deal was met with anger and defiance. The violence got so intense that the French ordered its citizens to leave. In a tense situation, hundreds of French nationals got trapped at the airport by angry pro-government demonstrators. There are also 2,500 French troops in Ivory Coast to monitor an existing ceasefire. According to the World Press Review magazine, the armed rebellion started last September when soldiers trained under the previous dictator, General Robert Gueni, seized a major military base. As a result, the rebels were better equipped than the army. The army suffered a major blow last December when mass graves were found in a village in western Ivory Coast. Witnesses said that soldiers looking for rebels came in and killed 120 civilians. Local human rights monitors have asked for an international investigation. While the U.S. is building up its attack force against Iraq and attempts to curtail a second crisis in North Korea as it flexes its nuclear muscle, the Bush administration has overlooked sales by American corporations that may contribute to nuclear proliferation. The White House has thus far refused to disclose the names of U.S. companies that sold so-called dual-use technology, such as supercomputers, that are sought by nations with nuclear ambitions like Iraq, India, Pakistan, and China. The Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, aided by the Public Citizen Litigation Group, has gone to federal court to obtain documentation of the 10,000 export license applications made in the mid-1990s. The Export Administration Act, first passed in 1969, regulates the export of technology that has both civilian and military use. The problem is that Congress has allowed the law to lapse several times, most recently in 1994. But then President Clinton extended it through executive order in 2000. In 1999, the Wisconsin Project filed a Freedom of Information request, which was later denied due to the expiration of the Export Act. Arms control advocates took their FOIA request to federal court, and the case is now on appeal. The January 8th arrest of white supremacist Matt Hale, leader of the World Church of the Creator, for allegedly ordering the murder of federal judge Joan Humphrey Lefkoe, has put hate groups on the defensive. 31-year-old Hale has long been a controversial figure for preaching anti-Semitism and referring to non-whites as subhuman and mud people. In a case overseen by Judge Lefkoe, an Oregon church had successfully sued Hale over the use of the name World Church of the Creator. In Chicago, Judge Lefkoe had ordered Hale to stop using the name. At a January 23rd bond hearing, federal prosecutors stated Hale emailed his security chief, ordering him to find the judge's home address. The security man replied, "When we get it, we can get rid of the rat." On a taped conversation, Hale added, "Good." According to the Christian Science Monitor, Hale's arrest is just one of a series of setbacks for white-led hate groups. In December, David Duke, another white supremacist, pled guilty to mail fraud and federal tax charges and faces a 15-month prison sentence. Still, hate groups, especially the World Church of the Creator, have significant reach, say civil rights groups in Chicago, Montana, and Seattle. They consider Hale's hate group one of the most violent in the United States. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
With the White House moving rapidly to deploy troops and the weapons of war necessary for their war against Iraq, the diplomatic endgame is now in sight. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell's presentation of evidence at the Security Council represented a final effort by the Bush administration to gain support for their war plans from an ever more skeptical American public, European allies, Russia, and China. While it's not yet clear whether Mr. Bush will seek a second resolution from the UN authorizing military action, it is almost certain the president is willing to disregard growing international opposition and launch a unilateral U.S. attack if necessary. The Bush administration puts forth three major reasons to rationalize their war plans: to destroy Baghdad's alleged weapons of mass destruction, to confront and reduce the threat of international terrorism, and to promote democracy in Iraq and the Middle East. But, although little talked about in the U.S., one of the major issues at stake in any future war with Baghdad is control of Iraqi oil. With Iraq sitting on top of the world's second-largest reserves of crude, the potential prize for the U.S. and American oil companies is enormous. Colin Powell stated recently that if the U.S. ousts Saddam Hussein from power, America plans to hold Iraq's oil fields, quote, in trust. But the industry publication Oil Daily reported that the State Department's Oil and Gas Working Group has been meeting to discuss post-war management of Iraq's oil sector, including the possibility of privatizing the industry. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Clare, professor of peace and world studies at Hampshire College, who assesses the control of Iraqi oil as a central motive behind President Bush's plan for a second Persian Gulf war.
Let me say to begin with that preventing the spread of weapons of mass destruction and fighting terrorism and promoting democracy are good things. I think all of us would like to see that happen. The question is whether that's really the motive for the president's war on Iraq, and that's where I'm doubtful. I tried to argue that if weapons of mass destruction were our primary concern and worry, we should be focused on North Korea and Pakistan before we turn to Iraq, because Pakistan and North Korea pose a much greater threat of weapons of mass destruction use than does Iraq at this time. And I argue that if terrorism is our concern, we really should be going after al-Qaeda and its member organizations, and that invading Iraq will help al-Qaeda, not confine it, not destroy it. And finally, I argue that if promoting democracy was our concern, I wonder why the president and his officials did not object to Saddam Hussein's tyranny when they were in positions of power before, in the first President Bush's administration, when the U.S. was allied with Saddam Hussein.
Now, if it's not the weapons of mass destruction, if it's not terrorism or democracy, what about oil? What about control of oil? You have written about the declaration of the Carter administration back in 1980, some call the Carter Doctrine, where he stated the U.S. position that it should control world oil security and our access to it. You want to expand on that?
The fact is that America has become dependent on oil from the Persian Gulf since World War II. We rely on Persian Gulf oil for a significant share of our total energy supply, and that dependency is growing all the time. And it has been U.S. policy since the Carter period to use military force when necessary to protect the flow of oil from the Gulf against any hostile power. And that was first declared by President Jimmy Carter in 1980 and then reiterated in 1990 by President George Bush Sr. when Iraq invaded Kuwait. And really what's happening now, I think, is a continuation of the Carter policy in the sense that Iraq can be seen as a threat to American dominance of the Persian Gulf oil region and a continuation of a policy to eradicate such threats.
What do you think the U.S. goal is in invading Iraq in terms of control of oil? Do you think the U.S. Will install its leader to direct oil resources back to the United States through U.S. Oil corporations? Or how do you think this will work for the U.S. in a way that won't be so blatant and really put the U.S. on the spot in terms of world condemnation?
You know, I don't think that the Bush administration is particularly worried about world condemnation. What the Bush administration is worried about is the fact that the United States of America is running out of oil. We were once self-sufficient in oil production up until the 1950s, but since then we've become ever more dependent on oil from the Persian Gulf. And this dependency is likely to grow enormously in the years ahead as American oil disappears. I think that's what worries them more than anything else. So we want control of the largest suppliers of oil in the world, and those are Saudi Arabia and Iraq. Iraq has the second largest supply of oil, perhaps is the first major supplier of oil in the world, if all of the undiscovered fields there bear fruit. And I think the administration is determined that American companies will have control over a significant portion of that undeveloped oil.
What's the potential for backlash here in terms of world opinion about the view that the United States is just crassly and belligerently going into another nation just to pirate its resources? Is that likely to develop into some, you know, large schisms across the globe that will haunt us later, do you think?
Well, I think those schisms are already there. Anybody who's traveled in Europe or read the European press or the Asian press, our students who've been traveling to Europe are constantly accosted by people in those countries. They'll say, we have nothing against you personally, but we despise your government's policies. And I think there's a lot of anger directed at this country. Now, what we have to worry about is, to what degree will that result in violence against us? And I do worry that if we invade Iraq, this will be viewed by many people, at least in the Islamic world, as an attack on Islam rather than an attack on Saddam Hussein. And that's why I feel that in the interests of counterterrorism, which I think really should be a priority, an invasion of Iraq is exactly the wrong approach. I think it's going to make conditions worse, not better.
That was Michael Clare, professor of peace and world studies at Hampshire College. He is the author of Resource Wars, The New Landscape of Global Conflict, published by Metropolitan Books. As organizing against the Bush administration's plans for war with Iraq intensifies, the voice of labor is rising. Opponents of a new war in the Persian Gulf got a big boost last month when 100 labor representatives met in Chicago to coordinate their efforts nationwide. There, members of unions such as AFSCME, American Federation of Teachers, Healthcare Workers 1199, Service Employees International, United Auto Workers, Carpenters, and many others formed a new coalition dubbed U.S. Labor Against the War. Union activists had a noticeable presence during massive protests against the war held on January 18th on both coasts and promised to be even more visible in upcoming demonstrations, including the February 15th actions in New York City and elsewhere. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Jean Bruskin, a labor leader based in Washington, D.C., and co-organizer of the new coalition U.S. Labor Against the War. Bruskin discusses labor's dissatisfaction with the Bush administration on several fronts and the groundswell of labor support for a new U.S. foreign policy.
After 9/11, the labor movement, like most people in the country, were pretty shocked at what had happened and pretty much felt like they needed to support the president getting the terrorists. But within a fairly short amount of time, people started feeling uncomfortable. Some people were uncomfortable with what happened in Afghanistan. And then as the Patriot Act was passed and the people also started seeing the president and the administration giving a lot of support to the airline industry, no support to the airline workers, when many, many hotel workers and other workers were losing their jobs all over the country, there was very little sympathy, and most of the assistance from the administration was for the various industries, the insurance industry and so on. So the labor movement started opposing a lot of the administration's policies, immigrant detention, and in addition to that, the administration started denying people in the labor movement the right to organize. Federal workers and Homeland Security had the right to organize taken away. A lot of immigrants who had legal work permits were working in airports in these security jobs for years, and they lost their job, weren't allowed to apply for the new ones. Then came the war in Iraq. The number of unions in different cities and towns had passed resolutions against some of the provisions of the Patriot Act and some of the things that the president had done in the wake of 9/11, even though for the most part the labor movement tends to be very patriotic, but we're getting very disenfranchised. When the threat to the war in Iraq came, the labor movement started organizing it, and in city and town and union after union all over the country in the last 4 or 5 months in particular, unions have passed resolutions opposing George Bush's rush to war, opposing the Patriot Act, opposing the amount of money that the government is spending for this potential war. What has happened is that there has now begun almost like a brush fire in places like Philadelphia and San Francisco, Chicago, Detroit, Seattle, North Carolina, all over the country. We find service employees union, Teamsters, even in some cases building trades, sometimes the Federation of Labor for the entire state. We have railroad workers, a huge variety of workers all over the country, passing resolutions opposing Bush's rush to war in Iraq and some of his domestic policies. And what happened in Chicago on January 10th was a call went out to many of the unions across the country to come to Chicago, send a representative, and let's begin to coordinate this anti-war activity. And that meeting, about 100 union representatives came. Most of them were sent on behalf of their union. And in that meeting, we formed U.S. Labor Against the War, a national umbrella for the organizing against the war that was taking place in the labor movement. Since then, and as a whole, there have been resolutions passed in labor organizations representing about 4.5 million workers. It's really, in some ways, an unprecedented amount of resistance that we're seeing in labor to U.S. foreign policy.
You mentioned a lot of different unions, both local and national unions that were involved. What unions would you say are leading this effort?
On the national level, farm workers, the United Farm Workers Union, the American Postal Workers Union has come out against the war. The AFSCME, which is American Federation of County, State, and Municipal Employees, UE, which is the National United Electrical Workers Union, and the Service Employees International Union, recently wrote a letter to Bush opposing the war. These are huge unions, some of them with 1 million members. And one of the more recent resolutions that just passed was the L.A. County Federation of Labor, which represents 800,000 workers from 80 different unions, passed a resolution unanimously opposing the war. You know, lots of people like the teachers, for example, realize that in a situation now where there's a budget crisis, that the money's going to go to the war. It's not going to go to the schools. And these are teachers trying to teach their kids to resolve their disputes peacefully while the president is showing that the way to resolve disputes is through war. So there's a lot of anger out there.
That was Gene Bruskin, co-organizer of the new coalition, U.S. Labor Against the War. For more information, call area code 917-282-0139 or visit the group's website at www.uslaboragainstwar.org. As America and the world mourn the loss of 7 astronauts aboard the space shuttle Columbia, destroyed as it re-entered the Earth's atmosphere on February 1st, hard questions are being asked about the cause of this tragic accident. But while efforts to recover debris of the spacecraft began across East Texas and Louisiana, it was evident from official warnings issued to the public that some materials aboard Columbia were potentially dangerous to human health. Since the mid-1990s, critics have sounded an alarm about NASA's use of radioactive materials in their spacecraft, which they maintain pose a risk of catastrophic accidents. As seen in the destruction of the Challenger space shuttle in 1986 and now with Columbia, the use of plutonium batteries and other toxic power sources on future missions poses a risk of accidents that could disperse these materials over wide areas of the Earth. Such an accident could expose millions to dangerous levels of radiation with the potential to cause cancer and other illnesses. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Lloyd Dumas, professor of political economy at the University of Texas. Dumas, author of Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility and Dangerous Technologies, discusses the lessons he believes government planners should learn from the loss of the Columbia space shuttle.
I think the space shuttle Columbia disaster is the latest in a series of warnings we've been given. Warnings in the sense that fallible human beings interacting with powerful technologies will inevitably cause accidents, cause disasters. Now, that's not to say that we have to worry about any technology we use, but there are certain technologies we have which have the potential for producing major disasters, and those are really too dangerous for a species as fallible as we are to be playing around with. Let me illustrate this in a different way. Think about the case of the shuttle. You have thousands of highly trained people focused intensely on trying to make sure everything goes right with the shuttle mission, and still we have a disaster like this. Now, we went 42 years in the space program without ever having a fatality on reentry for all of the manned space program, but it finally caught up with us. You see, and the point is that that will happen with any technology we use, from the wheel to the space shuttle. Every technology we've ever developed is subject to this kind of failure. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be using technology. Of course, that'd be silly. Ridiculous. But what it does mean is that we should be very cautious about using technologies such that when things really go wrong, a major disaster could occur, not with seven people dying, but maybe thousands of people dying.
There are critics, past and present, who have pointed out the danger of payloads that have been carried and are planned to be carried on future space missions, including plutonium batteries and even a proposal now on the drawing board for rockets powered by nuclear reactors, just narrowly on the space shuttle, et cetera. What are some of your concerns around these technologies?
Well, actually, let's take a look at the space shuttle Challenger when it blew up on launch in 1986, around this time of year. The fact is that most people don't realize the next mission scheduled for the Challenger space shuttle, it would have been carrying a payload which included a satellite powered by almost 47 pounds of plutonium. Plutonium is extremely toxic material. As little as 7/1000ths of an ounce, if inhaled, let's say as dust, is capable of killing someone within a few weeks. So we're talking about a very, very dangerous material. There were more than 100,000, well more than 100,000, so to speak, lethal doses in that much plutonium that would have been on the next Challenger. So the question is, what would have happened if the Challenger had exploded on that launch? And in fact, John Goffman, who is the former associate director of the Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Weapons Laboratories in California, was asked that question. And his answer was, if it gets dispersed over Florida, kiss Florida goodbye. That's a pretty dramatic way of saying it. But what he meant is there would have been a lot of people killed in such an accident, potentially. So, yes, it does connect to the space program. It doesn't make any sense for us to send up space payloads which have highly toxic materials in large amounts, like that much plutonium. In fact, you know, there have even been suggestions in the past that that's one way we should get rid of our nuclear waste, by loading it onto space vehicles and then shooting it into the sun. That seems like a crazy idea to me, because if it gets out of the Earth's atmosphere, wonderful. Well, what happens if it blows up on launch? I don't think we should even think about putting materials as dangerous as plutonium in any significant amounts on future space launches of any kind.
In view of the Challenger disaster and now this destruction of the Columbia space shuttle, do you think NASA and the U.S. government will take the steps necessary to forgo certain technologies in the space program to safeguard citizens of our nation and the world?
I'm not sure. I think it depends on a lot of public pressure. We have to, this whole business of choice of technology is a very important situation in which the public can play a major role. You don't have to be a scientist or an engineer to understand that people make mistakes, and you don't have to be a scientist or an engineer to understand that when those mistakes are made, you don't want to be dealing with something that could cause a major disaster. It's up to us to put pressure on the government in the space program and elsewhere to select technologies, to choose technologies that are not going to expose us to that kind of risk. There'll always be some risk. Well, there's a risk every time you get into a car, for that matter, when you go for a walk. That's part of life. But there's no reason for us to choose technologies that expose us to catastrophic risk. And I don't think the government is going to wake up to that point. I mean, we're very worried now, for instance, about Saddam Hussein maybe getting nuclear weapons, or the North Koreans getting nuclear weapons. I'm very worried about our own nuclear weapons and the weapons in the possession of Russia and India and Pakistan and so on. We have to worry about these things, and our government has not shown any ability to focus on this seriously without a lot of public pressure. So I think it's up to us. We have a right to say it. We have a right to demand that our fallibility, our tendency toward error, be taken into account when we choose technologies, whether for the military or for space. And I think we should do it. We have the ability to make a difference, and we should use that power.
That was Lloyd Dumas, professor of political economy at the University of Texas, Dallas. His book, Lethal Arrogance, Human Fallibility and Dangerous Technologies, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.